Welcome to Building Reddit. I'm your host, Ryan H. Lewis. If you visited Reddit with a web browser in the past few months, then you likely landed on our new front-end experience, which we internally have named Shreddit. This new implementation took years to finish and the effort of many engineers, but the end result is a faster and cleaner experience that's easier than ever to use. One of the engineers who works on that project, Lonnie Ingram, joined me on the podcast today. She's worked on several different aspects of Reddit's web front-end, from the text editor to the post composer, in her role as a staff front-end engineer. In our discussion, she shares more about how front-end development works at Reddit, some of the toughest bugs she's encountered, and what she's excited about on the web. I also need to apologize. This episode was recorded the day after Reddit's IPO, and my voice hadn't yet recovered. Anyways, here's our discussion.
To start with, Lonnie, what do you do at Reddit, and when did you start?
I started in March of 2023, so it's my one-year anniversary, and I'm a front-end engineer currently working on a rewrite of the submit page where folks create posts on Reddit. And I'm part of the Reddit Pro team. We're doing some work in that submit page to build out features for the businesses that we are bringing onto Reddit as first-class posters.
I think Reddit Pro is a newer thing. I didn't know what it meant for a while. So it's like more, I guess, brands or advertisers and allowing them to create posts in a different way, I guess.
Well, so what it allows for a brand to have a first class presence on Reddit. So like /you/ZomboCorp. And previously, you know, ZomboCorp could advertise with us and their employees could have Reddit accounts and they could post and identify themselves as ZomboCorp employees when they were posting. But what this is going to allow is for ZomboCorp to have like their own actual user account, and communities that are interested in having that brand participate can invite them in to post and do all the things that a Reddit user can do, but as that brand. So this opens up a lot of possibilities in terms of brand communication. And we also provide a really powerful suite of analytics and a dashboard that allows brands to surface the many conversations that are happening about their brand on Reddit and figure out which ones are worth responding to and, you know, which ones are the higher priority to respond to and figure out like, oh, there's a lot of chatter about us over in this community. Let's go find out what's going on over there. If there's anything we can do to influence the conversation or help people out, that kind of thing. So that's the high level summary of what Reddit Pro is.
Cool. Okay, let's talk about your workday. I'd love to hear, like, what does your typical workday look like? And maybe it's different every day, so maybe just, like, averaged over a week or a month or something.
So for a typical workday, we usually have, you know, kind of sync meetings in the mornings, either over Slack or over Zoom. And so once that's done, then my responsibilities are, you know, writing code, building features and fixing bugs, doing technical design work, figuring out like, what do we need to do in order to meet this business need? What can we do is another big part of that. It's just sort of like knowing the capabilities of the web as a platform and Reddit's platform and being able to translate that into like, here's the things that we can do that would meet your product, the needs of the product that you want us to work on. And then I spend a lot of time reviewing code. You know, I have a really great team working with me right now, and they ship a lot of code. And I've found that the way that I can have kind of the most impact is less like me trying to, you know, code as fast as them and churn out pull requests, and instead really focusing on doing deep and careful review of all of the big patches that are coming in and making sure that they meet our quality bar and that we're making good choices about the APIs that we're designing and that we're, you know, striking that balance between not YOLOing things too much and kind of building the fastest possible thing that could possibly work and then having that be a mess to maintain down the road. And on the one end of that spectrum, and then on the other end of the spectrum, kind of gold plating things and like, you know, spending a lot of time trying to decide whether an API should be, you know, like this or like that, and really there's no difference between the two. So that's, it's something that with my experience in industry and experience on the web really allows me to kind of bring great advice to the team in. And like, I have a, know a lot of weird, useful web APIs and things like that. So that really helps. And then I'm also involved in the a few like internal employee groups, the trans employees group and the women in engineering group here at Reddit. And I go to those meetings and participate with those folks because it's really lovely and rewarding.
I have two follow-up questions. First of all, I feel like code review is a, it's not a lost art, but it's something that I feel like people don't necessarily, especially in engineering, I don't know that we necessarily share tips or like talk about like how to really review code well. So is there anything that you like usually do that you feel like is very impactful?
Well, I think we all have our sort of like internal list of the things that we check for. And I have some of those, like as a example, our tooling doesn't distinguish between using the generic argument in TypeScript. So when you say, when you call like query selector to like grab an element to the DOM, you can either use the generic feature to say this thing that I'm grabbing is a button or a div or whatever it is, or you can cast it. And using the generic feature is slightly better for technical reasons that I don't remember off the top of my head and aren't worth getting into. But that's a great example of something that I do kind of like keep as like a let's check for this one, because we don't have, we don't yet have an automated linting check for that. That's on my like hackathon to-do list maybe. And then I spend a lot of time thinking about, I look at the tests and make sure that the tests are, that there are tests, that those tests are testing what they say they test, because sometimes what's written in the description doesn't match what's actually asserted in the test. So a lot of my comments are things like, hey, we also need to, we said that we're verifying this behavior, but we only check this part of the behavior in the actual test. We need to have assertions about these other two parts of that behavior. And the other one is making sure that we're not growing the public API of any of our components with unnecessarily or without thinking about it. Because once you expose something out of your component, then you, you know, you own it and you need to take care of it and maintain it for your users. And, you know, for internal things, that's a little bit lower of a bar because it's easier to go and like change all the places. But it's still disruptive. It's still, you know, changes how people are expecting to be able to use your component if you, you know, come back a week later and say, actually, that property that I exposed, I don't want to do that anymore. So that's private now. Here's a patch that fixes your code. Because they may be thinking like, oh, I can use this to fix X, Y, and Z things down the road. I think the last thing I would say about code review is that the hard truth that I've found about code review in my career is that there's not really a shortcut to good code review. You have to spend the time, and it takes longer than you would expect. And it can often take longer to review code than it took to write it. And so you really need to either have support from your leadership, your stakeholders for doing that intense and careful review, because it will take a lot of time and it will cut down your ability to ship. And often your team will ship code faster than you can review it. And that kind of leads to this tough cycle where, you know, you're never quite able to catch up and ship your own PRs. That can feel really bad, but if you're in a position like mine, where you're one of the more or the most experienced person on your team, that may be the right use of your time. That may be the thing that is the most impactful and that is going to, you know, drive forward the business's needs the fastest and the best. Or you might, you know, need to say, I need to limit my code review, or talk to your team about having them do more code review that's a little more careful so that they're slowed down a bit too.
Cool. Cool. I was also curious about the employee groups you mentioned. Like what, like each one might actually do something different. But I'm curious, what roles those play, how they might have like helped you, or like what y'all talk about, or like, you know, what happens in those groups?
Yeah, absolutely. So They're both what are called employee resource groups or ERGs, and a lot of companies have these. And they're basically a way for employees who share a particular piece of themselves, like their gender or their ethnicity, or a shared experience like being a veteran, to have community with each other, talk about issues that matter for that group in particular. And then they will often have, I think almost always have, like an executive sponsor. So who is your representative for that group, and you can talk to that person and raise, concerns, ask for things that your group needs. So for me, I really find community as the main thing that I'm getting from both of these groups. I really enjoy working with other women in tech. It's been a focus of mine for a long time, back from before I realized that I was a woman. And there's just, there's not as many of us. And it's really helpful to be able to talk in a safe environment with each other, ask advice. You can say, it can be anything from like, hey, this situation came up in my team where somebody's doing this thing and I don't like it. How can I get them to stop? Or this thing happened. Should I feel weird about it? Or is it okay? Like, have you run into this situation before? We had one women in engineering chat where we just talked about equity and like those of us who had more experience, like longer tenure. Cause these groups range from, folks who are quite early in their career, to folks who have extensive careers lasting, 20 or more years. And so that was a great opportunity to kind of like teach inside our group and help everyone to understand, like, here's how options work. Here's how RSUs work. Here's the advantages and disadvantages. Here's my advice on whether or not to hold or sell when you're stock vests, that kind of thing. And then the trans group is just really important because the trans experience is pretty tough right now, particularly in the United States. And having a group of folks who understand and who you can go to for help and support around things that, with your transition or issues that you've encountered at work, and also just to like have that community and experience and share the joy of being trans has been really, really special and really wonderful to have at Reddit. And Reddit has a really thriving trans community here. It's a great place to be trans. Yeah, that's what I get out of those groups is community, friendship, that fellowship. And in particular, for the trans one, it's like that. The thing that is hard to communicate as a trans person is, things are rough out there with the laws that are being passed that make it really difficult for us to exist in public. But as upsetting and scary as that can be, we're all also so happy and joyful because we are finally living as who we truly are and able to live in our bodies. And the joy that you feel when you can do that is really hard to overstate, and hard for folks who haven't experienced it to really understand. So having other folks who you can talk to at work who really get that has been lovely.
I love that. I love hearing that they are, working so well. Like, I think sometimes, Reddit is about community as like our product, but it's really nice to see that we're reflecting that internally as well. Okay. Now, another thing you shared is that you like to cook. And so I'm really curious. So I'm not a good cook. And so I'm always looking for like how I can get better. So do you have some expert level like techniques or tricks that you would care to share?
I've definitely got some high impact hacks. So the first of these is homemade stock. It's actually really easy to make your own like chicken or veggie stock at home. Particularly if you have an Instant Pot or a slow cooker or a pressure cooker, you can also just do it on the stovetop. It takes a little longer, but it's not substantially harder. And so what we do is we have a gallon Ziploc bag in our freezer. And whenever we're doing prep to cook, we put aromatic veggie and herb scraps in there. So I say aromatic because you have to be careful not to include any of the brassicas, the broccolis, cabbages, the whole huge family, because they get bitter, unfortunately, in a stock. So does citrus. So if you were to put lemon peels in there, you might think, oh, cool, now my food will taste like lemon. And it will for a little bit at the beginning of the stock, but not by the time the stock's actually ready, it'll just taste bitter. So you say things like the paper from garlic is full of flavor, onion paper full of flavor. If you cut the ends off of your onions before you chop them up, you can throw those in there. Leek tops. So if you're only using the white or light green part of a leek, you can cook the green parts. By the way, they're great grilled, and if you slice them up really thin or cut them up into really small pieces, they also work well in sauces and stews, but they can be a little chewy, so people often toss them, and they are lovely in a stock. So you put stuff like that in your bag in the freezer, and we usually have one for veggie scraps and one for like chicken scraps, carcass, and like bones and stuff. And whenever they fill up, I make stock. And that usually looks like putting it all in the Instant Pot and putting it on pressure cook for 4 hours and walking away. And when it's done, I strain it out and I pour it into ice cubes. So particularly any like normal ice cubes will work. But if you've got those like big Scotch Rocks ice cube trays that a lot of folks got when the Scotch was real big for a few years, those work great because then you could just take like one big cube and that's, you know, like a cup of stock. And you freeze it and then you've got like really lovely homemade stock available all the time and sort of like a cycle going where you can you're always replenishing your supply. So that's what I would say is like one of the biggest bang for your buck things you can do. Another one is that has completely changed the game for me was learning how to make a pan sauce and how to make a roux. So it sounds fancy and they talk about it on the cooking shows, but it's actually dead easy. And it pulls in this stock thing, right? So like the idea is this, let's say you're going to make a pork chop. And so you're pan searing your pork chop on the pan and you take it off and it's resting. You should always make sure you rest your meat before you cut it so the juices don't run out. But there's all this like yummy brown flavor stuff in the pan that you would love to be able to taste. And the way that you do that is you make what's called a pan sauce. So the way that I do that is I will add a little fat to the pan if necessary. Sometimes you don't need to because there's enough fat already there. But if I need a little butter or a little oil or something, I'll put that in. I'll usually quickly saute some chopped up garlic or maybe some onion or something. And then once that's like good and going and looks like it's yummy, then I'll take a tablespoon of flour and I will sprinkle that across and I'll kind of like whisk that around, not too fancy. It's like not hard to get right. You just kind of move it around until all of the flour is mixed with the fat and has a chance to cook for like 30 seconds or so. And then you want to deglaze with the liquid. And what deglazing does is it helps to get all of the like brown bits up off the pan and into a liquid that you can then consume. And that's where the stock comes in because stock is lovely for that. So if you grab a couple cubes of your frozen stock and melt it down on the stove while you're making your pork chop, then you can just pour that in and stir it up. And the roux will bake it so that sauce gets that lovely kind of silky, thick enough to be substantial, but not like chunky consistency. Then you just kind of like season to taste, add salt and pepper, add a little acid if you want to, like from a apple cider vinegar or something like that. And it really is a lovely way to reuse more of the food that you're producing and like level up a meal in a way that is like really, you know, pretty great for the level of impact. So I would say that that's my other hot pro tip is learn how to make a roux in a pan sauce because it really, really rocks.
Cool. Okay. Stock and roux / pan sauce. Cool.
Stock and roux sounds like the name of a restaurant.
I'm sure it exists. If it doesn't, it should.
Yeah. We'll make a food truck.
Cool. I'm curious, did you, with the stock things that you shouldn't put in there, did you learn that by experience or did you like read that somewhere?
I read it about cabbage and broccoli. I learned it by experience with the citrus. Cause we love using citrus. And I put a bunch in there and I was bummed out. It was still, you know, it was still edible. We could still use that stock. But we had to do a little more work to kind of tamp down the bitterness and whatever we were using it in.
Okay. So I'd love to hear more. So you're currently at Reddit, your staff front engineer, but focusing on front end.
Staff front end engineer, yeah.
So I'd love to hear about your background, like how you got into tech and how you kind of like leveled up your career to this point.
Yeah. So I first got into tech kind of most broadly defined as a young girl. My dad encouraged us to encouraged everyone, all the kids to learn how to program. And I was the one who really got the most into it. And so I learned Quick Basic and C++ in high school. And I was going to go to college for that. But then that was right when the like independent film thing happened with like, this was the late 90s. I know. So like Swingers and Pulp Fiction came out and I decided I wanted to be a film director. And so I started off going to film school at the University of Texas, ended up not really thriving, had some pretty profound undiagnosed ADHD that was really making it hard for me to actually succeed. And so after, you know, kind of some fits and starts, I was working as a Visual Basic 6 programmer. And then the .com bust happened. And there was just, you know, a bazillion people on the market looking for work who had way better, way more experience and qualifications than me. So I ended up joining the Air Force. And I served in the Air Force for almost 4 years. They let me out a couple months early to start college back up on time. And I worked in as an electronics maintenance technician, what's called a computer networking switching and cryptographic systems maintenance tech. And we worked on that weird list of things. It's sort of like one of those deals where like they took all the odds and ends that were left over after other career fields and said, well, these people will do all of that. So we worked on like Cisco routers and switches. We worked on maintaining Windows networks and PC hardware. And then we also maintained military grade encryption devices. That one sounds like the cool part, but it was actually the most boring part because we didn't know anything about how they worked at all. Like none of the cool parts, you would hook it up to a machine and you would swap parts in the thing until the lights on the machine turned green. And that told you that last part was the one that was broken and you would mail it off and then you would replace that part. And then you were done with that bot. So it was really mind numbing work.
How many parts were there? Like how many parts would you have to do that with?
This was a KG-84. And so, it had like, I want to say on the order of like 6 to 8, boards that you could swap out. And then there were a few other replaceable components. I don't remember the specifics of those. And I need to be careful that I don't
talk not like
in any,
It wouldn't take you all day. It would be maybe like a maybe an hour.
Well, like, and while each, any, you also have to like try different settings. So you have like a technical reference that would walk you through the steps of diagnosing what the failure was. Okay. And so there was no like, there was very little discretion or application of experience. I mean, certainly more experienced techs might be like, that looks like this problem. Let's check that first. But what you would fall back on if that didn't work was you just go step by step and you follow the pages of the guide, and it tells you switch this to this and turn this toggle on, and what, you know, here's what you should see. If you don't see it, then go to page 12, sort of thing. The other cool thing about those, about that particular machine is that it had a dot painted on it. And that dot was where you would put the muzzle of an M16 to destroy the device in the event that your base was being like overrun by the bad guys. And so it was where if you shot into that dot, the bullet would pass through all of the classified components inside of the device, which I've always thought of as just like an incredibly interesting product concern, you know, like very distinct from my world today.
It's the same with MacBooks, right? Where the Apple is. That's
yes, if you shoot yes, through that's it, right. Yeah, shoot through that, and that'll get the hard drive.
Cool. Okay. So Air Force. Yeah. What happened then?
Yeah. So then, got out of the Air Force. So when I was backing up slightly, I really enjoyed the Air Force and was thinking about making it a career. But then when I was deployed to Afghanistan in 2004, I got the opportunity to do some programming and rediscovered my love for it and said, oh, this is what I want to do. I don't want to do this in the military because the, you know, it's a creative endeavor and the military is not really a place that is where those kinds of like creativity flourishes necessarily. And so I pivoted and focused on going back to school, returned to college in 2006 and eventually later that spring got a job through a friend who hired me to work on, survey-based usability testing, product, and it was scripted with JavaScript. And so he said, you're gonna have to learn JavaScript. And I said, what's that? And then I, you know, did some Googling and said, okay, sure. And it, you know, it turned out to be a really great time to learn JavaScript. That's right when, Doug Crockford was really, kind of evangelizing it and jQuery was getting big. And so it was a really wonderful time to jump onto that wave. And to get involved in a really cool community. And so I've been working since then in a variety of front-end focused roles, primarily in a bunch of different environments. So, you know, there's that non-traditional one. So there's that survey-based thing. I worked at a high-frequency trading company for a year. I worked building a console, a management console for a server appliance. Actually didn't work on like a traditional website until about almost 10 years into my career when I started at RetailMeNot. So I did that for like 10 years and then I pivoted into tooling. I kind of ended up on like the platform side of things. And it's hard to imagine today, but there used to not be a lot of tools for front-end technology. And so it was... there's a lot of like kind of discovery and more researchy, hacky type stuff happening at the company level, as opposed to, you know, installing all the wonderful tools that we have now and figuring out how to make them work together. So I got involved in that and kind of spent about 4 years doing dev tools and dev platforms work at Indeed before coming back to the web at my last role at Stripe. And then finally coming back to actual product work here at Reddit, which I've been really excited to do. And was a little worried about because it had been so long since I'd done product work, but I've really found it to be, you know, like riding a bike, I guess, one of those things. And the tech stack that we're using is really quite lovely. We use a framework called lit.html, which is a web component based framework that grew out of Google's Polymer project. And it's been a real, I'd never used it before. I'd never heard of it until I started it, read it, and it's been a real delight to use.
Yeah, so you've worked, you know, even in the tooling domain, you've done front end at a lot of different places. I'm curious, what are some of the things you've noticed or that you feel is maybe unique at Reddit in the front end kind of space?
Well, that's a great question. Unique in my career would be the use of web components for sure. That's not been something that I've run into. I've been excited about web components and been watching them as they've kind of moved along from like early standards type stuff to becoming much more mature and now being used in production websites like Reddit. So I've found it really nice to tackle things from that component-based perspective. The community at Reddit has also been really lovely, the internal community. You know, front end kind of got a bum rap for a long time and still does in some circles as like not a real programming career. Like you're not actually doing programming. Like it's like, you know, JavaScript is a thing that the server spits out. When the real code runs on the server, it like emits it in the same way as HTML. And that's like just output. It's not, you know, a real application. And that's changed a lot over my career, but you still run into it. And at Reddit, it's been really nice not to run into very much of that at all. People are generally respectful of like how hard it is to build delightful, complicated, interesting web applications and how many things like that you really do have to think about as you're building a website like Reddit. And so I've really loved that aspect. And we have a pretty good, the web platform team that builds our internal tooling has really been making a really amazing experience for us. And they're continually improving. And there's a whole laundry list of things that they for them to keep working on. They're not going to run out of stuff to do anytime soon. But the current state of things is really, really, really quite nice. We have a good tech stack and good automation, and it really feels like it gets out of your way most of the time.
Can I ask about, okay, so I pretty much stopped doing most of my front end stuff right before web components actually started being like implemented in browsers. Like it was like the standard, and you mentioned Polymer. That was like, look, you can use it before it's actually available. So I'm curious, like with lit.html, you mentioned that uses web. That's like, I guess, built on web components or uses them. What does lit bring? Kind of like, what does lit bring that web components, raw web components, don't already have?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what it brings is it abstracts away some of the sort of tricky bits of the web component API. So, you know, when you're building these sorts of, when you're standardizing and building these sorts of APIs, there can often end up being kind of sharp corners and things that are a little tricky. And Lit helps to kind of smooth all that out, provide like, a uniform and well-documented API on top of that. They do a great job of not adding anything that they don't need to, which I really, really love, because a problem that I've run into in the past with other frameworks is that they'll like rebuild things that already exist, and they'll kind of have their own sort of take on how that should work. And then the web shifts, right, as it's going to continue to do. And then their API or their abstraction is now not convenient. It's actually kind of getting in the way. And so Lit does a really good job of saying, you know, like I've had multiple times had the experience in reading the Lit docs and seeing some like term or token or object type in there and saying, what the heck is that? I've never seen that before. And I can't find it in the documentation. And that's because it's on MDN, because it's just part of the web standard. And they're elevating all that into their framework, which I really love. And then I think the main contribution, other than sort of like dealing with all those details, is that Lit provides reactive properties. So when you change a public property or even a private property in a component, then that will trigger an update lifecycle that you can hook into in a predictable and well documented way. And that's super crucial, because if you don't have that kind of framework in place, then you'll end up with like 19 different versions of that kind of thing built by different teams that don't work the same way and each has their own like weird little idiosyncrasies. So just providing that like really solid functionality and an API that's well thought through, narrow but not like too narrow, allows us to all focus on building the stuff that matters rather than kind of like coming up with all these different, like spending a lot of time building our own APIs or, you know, getting our different APIs that we've come up with as like separate efforts to like talk to each other. So Lit kind of provides that glue and that common framework there, and they do a good job.
I did have one question. So you talked about the kind of what you're focusing on. One of the things you're focusing on now is the post composer, like when people create a new post, users create a new post, what they use essentially to do that. I'm curious, were there any challenges you ran into? Anything that was maybe surprisingly difficult or a technical challenge?
Yeah, let me think. So the trickiest technical challenge that I've actually run into recently was that there's a backend. So moderators on Reddit had the ability to schedule a post for the future to say, like, I want this to post in my subreddit like 2 weeks from now. And you can even like make those like a regular thing. So like every 2 weeks or every month, there's like a contest or whatever it is. They can set that up in advance. They don't have to recreate it every time. And the way that that was represented on the back end was a little different than normal. And it looked like a typical ISO date string. So like year-month-day-T and then hours, minutes, seconds. And then normally there's a time zone part of that. And we don't include that in this field and instead have a separate field, which is the name of the time zone, like US/Pacific or Americas/Los Angeles. And that turned out to be really tricky to figure out how to take those two bits of data and turn them into a date object in the browser, because there's no native date API where you can take those two things and just kind of like naively throw them in a function call and get back your date. Fortunately, there's the INTL API, which is one of these newer web APIs that solved a huge problem that I spent a lot of time worrying about back earlier in my career and has now been completely solved, which is lovely. And so what we ended up having to do is we took those two pieces of data and we used it to generate two different dates, one in UTC time and one in the time that was named in the time zone field. And neither of which was the actual time that we wanted, but they had the appropriate offset. So we were able to subtract the two, get the actual offset that we needed, and then use that to reconstruct the original time. And that took me a few days to figure out. And at one point I was like, this, we can't do it. It's not possible. But I kept plugging and eventually figured it out. A great little coda to that story is I was telling a friend and former coworker in my career about this whole thing after I'd figured it out and kind of described the problem in similarly like abstracted safe for public consumption terms, and they expected them to be so impressed by me solving this like mystery of the web. And they said, "Oh yeah, well I think you just kind of like probably would generate the two dates and then like separate, like subtract them to get the offset and use that to like, now it's just so, it's like, why didn't I ask you, you know, 3 days ago? But it's fun to go on those sort of mysteries and do those investigations. So that, I think that would be one of the bigger technical challenges. A lot of the other technical challenges just have to do with like, it's a complicated page, you know, like it seems like, oh, this should be pretty straightforward, but we allow a variety of different kinds of posts and we allow folks to tag those posts with flair. You can have gallery posts, you can have video posts. We really support a pretty rich set of different kinds of content that you can create on Reddit. And so providing the equivalent experience to what folks are using on the current website was a lot of detail work to figure out, like, how do we make sure that we maintain compatibility where it matters on the product?
It's really funny how dates and times are so difficult. And then you think back to like Y2K, that was the whole source of that too. Exactly, but like, yeah, it's crazy how important and difficult those are.
Yeah, if you ever get the chance to talk to somebody who's worked maintaining like a time server or a time service, that kind of thing, it's really fascinating to learn about like all of the wild stuff that happens. Time zones change, you know, like there's a political aspect to this. So there's no like way to come up with like a clear set of rules that you can just encode like compactly and then know what time any like moment in time would be. Because, you know, you might have a date from 1967 and then in 1969, they changed how time zones work in some particular country. And they might do it tomorrow, you know, like Mauritania might decide to change what time zone they're in or you know, have like a daylight spendings time. I don't know. And so like the people at the operating systems are like, there's some really good talks and blog posts about all of the like intricacies of this. And the other part about that that's fun is that in some places in the world, there's different governmental authorities that both claim to say what the time zone should be and who disagree. And so that's another tricky bit is you don't want to make sure that your like way of depicting time zones accidentally gets you like canceled by one side of some like, you know, regional dispute.
That's why you're staff level, because you're aware of all those things. I didn't even know about half of those.
Honestly, like in the sense that as I've progressed in my career, I've learned more and more that it's less about the tech and more about the people. I really do think that that's actually a really very true and deep statement that you made there, because I think, you know, there's different kinds of staff engineers. And I want to be clear that like whatever shape of staff engineer you are, as long as you're like rocking and delivering that value to the business, then keep doing what you're doing. But I've found that often the role of staff engineers is to think about beyond the technical parts, like how did the people involved in shipping this and in maintaining this and in monitoring it, how did those people systems interact? And how can we improve efficiencies and help those folks to work together is like a lot of the work and a lot of where you kind of bring that experience to bear. Sometimes it's as simple as saying like, well, let's just go ask them, you know, like there've been so many meetings that I've been in where like, we're like, oh golly, well, if this team does this, then we'll have to do this other thing. And if that team does that, then we'll have to do a different thing. And what are we going to do? And I just say like, well, we're all in Slack. Let's just go ask, you know, let's tell them what we're doing and ask them what they're planning to do. And let's make a plan together. It doesn't have to, you know, we don't have to have a Gantt chart, but we can just have a little chat and make sure that we're not, that we're all on the same page and that nobody's surprising anybody. Nobody's putting anybody in a position where they feel upset or want to push back or dig their heels in. You know, a lot of early and liberal application of kind of polite and friendly, proactive communication with the various other teams that you interact with can make a really big difference in getting your product shipped.
Let's talk about you've been in the web game for a long time. You've seen a lot of things. Tell me about what you're kind of like excited about, like what you kind of maybe see on the horizon for front end tech, but also just things that you think are interesting and worthwhile.
So I have a particular interest in building in sandboxing things on the web. I did a research project as part of my undergrad around that. And so I'm really have been paying attention for a long time to WebAssembly and the kind of the work that folks have been doing to turn the browser into this powerful virtualization platform where you can, you know, like I used to love taking out my phone and showing how you can boot Linux in a tab to professors at my university and just like blowing their minds. And they're like, what is this magic? This must be a trick. And it's like, nope, it's just this French guy who's really good at programming and he built a JavaScript VM. And so I'm super stoked about the really hard work that's going into making WebAssembly garbage collectible. So WebAssembly is a technology that allows other languages besides JavaScript to run on the web platform, which is a big thing because I'm not a language partisan. And I found that a lot of times when people talk trash about JavaScript, it has less to do with the reality of using JavaScript and more to do with, you know, what they're used to or sometimes with kind of biases against front-end development. It has been true that, you know, it's JavaScript or nothing as far as like writing behavior on the web goes. And so being able to open that up to many other programming languages is, I think, wonderful because democratizing the web and giving more people the ability to contribute is something that I'm super in favor of. And so WebAssembly grew out of an effort to make it possible to run like C++ code, C code, things that are not garbage collected. In other words, they allocate their memory in advance. So if you're going to like have like a list of things, then you would need to think about, okay, how many things am I likely to have and how big is each one of those in terms of bytes? And then actually say, browser, please give me 64K for this or 64 megs. And if you run out of that data, like of that allocated memory, you have to allocate more and figure out like, okay, well, now do I like have two places that I'm checking or, you know, there's like a lot of complications as opposed to a garbage collected language like Java or Python or JavaScript, where you just say, I want a list and I'm going to add things to that list. And all of the details of actually allocating the room for that data in the memory of your computer is handled by the runtime of the language that you're using. And so WebAssembly, despite running on top of a garbage collected environment in the browser, did not expose that garbage collection capability to code running inside. And so you either had to bring your own garbage collector, which adds a ton of weight and complexity and maintenance burden to your application, as well as a huge performance hit as well. Or you just couldn't use languages like that were garbage collected. And the thing that really bums me out about that is that those are often the more accessible languages, you know? Those are the things that people are learning earlier in their careers and the languages that provide kind of the experience that allows less technical folks to contribute and build on the web. And that's something that I think is really important. So I'm super stoked. There's a lot of progress being made on that. There's early versions shipping in most of the major browsers. Safari will catch up, I'm sure, someday. So that's one of them. And then the other one is another long-term interest of mine, which is accessibility. Way back in my post-Air Force student days, I went to South by Tech. I don't even remember what it was called. I think it was called South by Technology, something like that. And there was a booth where you could go and they had a computer set up to browse your website and with a screen reader. And they had folks who were screen reader users who would kind of guide you through that and give you the experience of the web that they had, which really blew my mind because it was just so different than my experience of the web as a sighted user. And accessibility is super important, but it's often like one of the later concerns because it's expensive It's hard. It's very complicated. And it's frustratingly manual. You know, there's not a lot of automated, or there has not until recently been a lot of automated tooling around accessibility that allows us to have the same sort of quality bar that we do in other areas. You know, like one of the things that I've really seen over my time in my career is seeing automated testing on the web become, rather than like a thing that the best companies did, like table stakes. You know, they're, I haven't worked anywhere in the last 10 years where there weren't automated tests that ran as part of like the pipeline for shipping something. But unfortunately, it's really hard to make accessibility part of that. There's like linter type things, and like those can be really powerful, but there's not been tooling that is as good at or provides like that kind of unit test type thing, like I click this or I select this using my user agent, and the user agent or the screen reader, then the assistive technology, then like speaks these words and I can assert that the correct words are spoken. And so the work that's going into the accessibility object model, which is a way of exposing in the same way that the DOM exposes the data structures that represent the visual representation of content in your browser screen, there's this AOM, accessibility object model, that represents in the same way the accessibility information about the application. And so that's going to allow, I think, once it ships, and actually even over the next few years, because people are going to start building on top of it now, I think that there's going to be a real explosion of cool testing technology around accessibility. And I think that that's super important, because coming back to my what I said earlier about the web as a platform for everyone, it has just really been a shame to watch industry talk about the importance of accessibility but not invest in it super heavily over my career. And I'm really hoping that this will be an opportunity for us to make up that gap and make sure that we're building experiences that truly are available to everybody.
Okay. Any last words? Anything else you want to say?
No, this has been a lovely conversation. I hope folks will check out the new Post Composer when it comes out later this year. You know, don't say mean things about it because I'll be sad. No, I'm kidding. Say whatever you want. We're gonna make it as best as we can, and we love feedback. You know, Reddit is hiring. So if what I've said about what it's like working here sounds compelling, I really urge you to check out our job listing. This place has been a really wonderful place to work. It's a place where people are working hard or shipping things, but also it's not like a, why can't you type faster? You know, you need to be 7% more productive next quarter sort of vibe. And people are really nice to each other internally, which has been really lovely. You know, often at previous companies, there's some corner of the company where there's people who are cranky and you try not to talk to them. And I haven't encountered anything like that here. Everyone has been utterly lovely and friendly and helpful. And it's been a real delight.
So what do you think? Does it sound cool to build Reddit, one of the largest sites on the internet? If so, check out our open positions at www.redditinc.com/careers. And to get more behind the scenes info, check out Reddit's engineering blog at reddit.com/r/redditeng. And that's it for now. See you in the next episode of Building Reddit. Building Reddit is an official podcast from Reddit. This episode was produced by Ryan H. Lewis. Thanks for listening.